From the studios of KPCW, it's This Green Earth. It's a weekly talk show about the environment and our impacts on it. I'm Claire Wiley, and joining us in the first part of the show is David Gilbert. He is the author and political ecologist who shares more on his new book, Countering Dispossession, Reclaiming Land, a Social Movement Ethnography. In his book, Gilbert provides an account of a group of Indonesian agricultural workers who began occupying the agribusiness plantation near their homes about two decades ago. In the years since, members of this remarkable movement have reclaimed collective control of their land and cultivated diverse agricultural forests on it, repairing the damage done over nearly a century of abuse. Then coming on the show is Utah State University's Larissa Yocum. With the devastating fires happening in California, we take a closer look at fire ecology with Yocum, who is an assistant professor of fire ecology in the Department of Wildland Resources and Ecology Center. She will talk us through the environmental factors that affect fire, including fuels, weather, and topography. All that and more on today's This Green Earth. Joining us in the first part of the show is author and political ecologist David Gilbert. David, thank you so much for joining us here on This Green Earth.
Great to be here with you.
Typically, we like to start off with a little background on our guests. So tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got involved in, say, the environmental field, and specifically, if I have this right, environmental anthropology.
Yeah, that's right. You know, starting around 2005, I started becoming engaged in environmental struggles in California and started learning a lot more about where our food comes from. And that led me to start working with a group that's still quite active in the industrial food space called the Rainforest Action Network. Mm-hmm. And we set up a campaign looking at where, you know, a lot of our food was coming from through the industrial processes of like giant monoculture plantations. And we learned, you know, there was a lot of soy coming from the Amazon. We learned there's a lot of corn coming from the Midwest. And we learned that there was a lot of this commodity called palm oil that was coming from Southeast Asia, mostly Indonesia. And this is a commodity that, you know, we don't see or smell or taste that much, but it's in more than half of the products that are found in our supermarket. It's in our pharmaceuticals, cosmetics. And that led me to Indonesia to start to understand what was going on with industrial food and plantations there and their connection with deforestation, the threatening of endangered species like the orangutan, the Sumatran rhino as well. And for me, kind of most movingly, the exploitation of workers in those places. And I spent years actually working on this campaign. We were campaigning against a company named Cargill. Many call it the largest company you've never heard of, a private corporation in the United States that is involved with a fair amount of the trade of palm oil as well as other industrial food products. And, you know, I saw a lot of things. I saw forests burning, you know, as far as you could see, rainforests. I saw workers being treated really terribly at these plantations. And I started wanting to know, you know, where can we find a bit of hope or inspiration in like this really difficult, difficult place? And I learned of the story of Casa Vera, the story I retell in this book. Right. And this was really quite an inspiring movement of one-time plantation laborers that organized as part of kind of the global land back movement to eventually reclaim their land, to get their land back from a plantation mm-hmm. company. And over the last now almost two decades, not only did they get their land back kind of through a direct action occupation, not only were they able to hold on to it in the face of a lot of repression from the Indonesian police forces and corporate agricultural company, they've been able to cultivate this incredible landscape, this like thriving landscape of what we call food forests, or that's Western scientists call agroforests or agricultural forests.
Right.
You know, it's a place that looks and smells like a rainforest. You know, it's alive with sounds of birds and rainforest animals, but it's actually a completely planted rainforest landscape full of really valuable commodities like avocado, cinnamon, chocolate, you know, the things that we know and love and consume are now being right. produced there, but in a way that's completely different than this industrial agricultural model.
Well, let's break all this down a little more. Talk about the Cassiavera as far as their land practices and farming practices prior to, I guess, their land being, you know, them being dispossessed.
Yeah, you know, there's a long history there, and it has to do with the rise of industrial food systems. Indonesia was one of the original places where these plantations were put into practice, first by Dutch colonists, now more than 100 years ago. So this is a system of agriculture that involves first cutting down the rainforest, and then massing laborers to plant in long rows of crops, just a single commodity like oil palm or rubber or tobacco. And that's what happened in Cassiavera. During Dutch colonialism, first colonists came and they logged that place. They cut down all the rainforest. Then they started growing coffee in this industrial model. And then eventually they started growing mostly tobacco and also ginger in this industrial model. And this was a time of great hardship, people told me. You know, this is a time where people were making the equivalent of $1 or $2 a day. They were spraying pesticides from backpack sprayers. They were out under the harsh sun doing these repetitive moments with a small hoe, something that's just brutal on your back. Actually, a tool that was made illegal in California based on the lobbying of none other than Cesar Chavez, the famous labor activist in California. You know, using this tool all day long, a great toll on their bodies. And then they talked about the overseers that were always present, and the lack of freedom and the, you know, the lack of any real future that they felt laboring on this plantation. So these were the conditions that they felt like were untenable. And on top of the really difficult conditions, there was always this feeling like the land itself was theirs, that the land had been taken from them without their consent, first under colonialism, and then again during the rise of Indonesia's new order, one of the, you know, 20th century's most murderous and genocidal dictatorships. So there's this great feeling of injustice, right? And that feeling didn't go away through the generations. It only kind of built until eventually there was an opening. And after a great deliberation, long time spent organizing underground, they decided to go up to the land and take it back.
And who is the main beneficiary of what was happening when you talk about this new order? Who is benefiting from this if it's not the people of the land there?
Well, you know what? Industrial agriculture is an interesting industry because it requires a great amount of land and a great amount of labor. And in this case, with this commodity we've been speaking about today, with oil palm, almost all of that land is in just a few countries, mostly Indonesia, Malaysia, although the crop is becoming more common in South American countries and African countries. But most of the companies that are doing this are based in other places, you know, so Cargill is a huge player in the industry. They're based in the United States. A number of other countries are incorporated in Singapore, although, you know, most of their management is from what we call the global north, you know, Europeans or Americans. And so during the New Order, there was this huge resurgence in what was originally a colonial model of agriculture. There's this huge resurgence in industrial agriculture and the handing over of lands that belong to indigenous people, the smallholder family farmer peoples, and handing it over to these companies. And so when we talk about really who is benefiting in this type of industrial agriculture, very much it was these companies and their shareholders in the case of private companies, or public companies. In the case of private companies, it was really quite a small group of people that were accumulating all the profits from this model of agriculture. So when we talk about the new order, you know, we talk about an a thing called an oligarchy, right? Like a really small clique of people that are very close to the center of power that accumulated huge profits, I mean, billions of dollars from this way of using the land, where the people that felt like they who were the true owners of the land, the longtime users of the land, often didn't benefit at all. Often they were evicted and kicked off the land, and laborers from other places were brought in to work there. So when we're talking about global land back movements, you know, we're talking about overcoming these long histories of injustice about how land is used, both in places like Indonesia, but of course also in the United States, when we talk about American Indians and what happened to their lands in our own histories.
Right. Well, let me reintroduce you. We're speaking with Dr. David Gilbert. He's a postdoctoral researcher in society and the environment at the University of California at Berkeley, and the author of the new book, Countering Dispossession, Reclaiming Land, A Social Movement Ethnography. So, Dr. Gilbert, how did the Cassiavera go back or reclaim their land? I mean, how complicated and difficult a process was that?
Yeah, this is a long, really inspiring story that began, as I said, underground during the New Order, when any type of organizing was illegal. And just even talking about challenging the power of a plantation authority could end up in jail, or even worse, disappeared or killed. But it began with a lot of conversations about making sure people were on the same page, that the people there in Cassiavera, they didn't agree with what was going on and they wanted to change it. And those conversations went on for years, as I understand. I spent about a year with the Cassiavera reclaiming movement, learning this history. So they spent years just talking and seeing who supported this idea of going up and occupying the plantation. And after they felt like they had a few hundred people that were interested in doing this, mostly plantation laborers that were originally from the area, but also some really important local politicians, they chose one day to go kind of not directly into the middle of the plantation where it was operating, but kind of on the edges, you know, where there's kind of a gray zone where it wasn't being really intensively cultivated, but was well within the boundary of the plantation as the company claimed it. They went up to that area and they started clearing the land and planting it with vegetable crops, like quick growing crops. Things like chili peppers that in Indonesia can grow in just a matter of weeks. So they began by using the land this way. And eventually they started to gain some momentum. Private security kind of came around, but never really pushed them too hard. And more people started going to these edges of the plantation and using the land. And as they saw that no police came to stop them, as company security seemed kind of weak in this situation, they started moving closer and closer in. Eventually, things kind of came to a head. And the group of reclaimers set up a blockade of the road into the plantation. And this was kind of a moment where they decided they were going to kick the company out. And they set up a blockade, and eventually military police came to try to break up that blockade. But in what was kind of a culmination of many years of struggle, the police chose to leave their guns on their shoulders, and they didn't fire on the protesters, as had happened in other similar land back occupations in Indonesia. And that came down to the fact that the reclaimers were actually able to convince one of the most important police officers in the area to support their cause. And that was like one of these interesting moments for me to realize that, you know, things are kind of sometimes up to happenstance. Sometimes these type of movements rely on personal relationships that are formed. And indeed, it turned out that police officer was a relative of one of the leaders of the land reclamation movement. So that was one of those pivotal days where the occupation could have ended, but it didn't. It continued on. There was a second blockade But for me, you know, another critical thing that allowed this experiment in living otherwise to flourish was that it wasn't just about protesting. It wasn't just about this blockade. It was also that all along, reclaimers were engaging in their own form of agriculture, this mixed form of agroforestry. They were planting these different tree crops. Underneath, they were planting vegetables. And over the years, as this kind of occupation grew, this agriculture grew alongside it, and the trees grew up and they kind of became durable. And eventually the fact that this agriculture was taking place became a really strong support for the occupation itself. And eventually the company kind of gave up trying to cultivate the area because they weren't able to use the land very well, because the occupiers or the reclaimers were using most of it. And at that moment, the reclaimers felt their boldest, and they actually went up and destroyed the manager's offices. They destroyed workers' barracks. And that was kind of the end of the company as it was able to operate more or less. And there's a longer story where the company brought a lawsuit to try to hold the reclaimers liable, which they actually ended up losing in the Indonesian court. And eventually the governor of the province where this reclamation movement unfolded kind of lent their support for the reclaimers based on ideas of justice, based on ideas of undoing the colonial legacy of these land uses. And to this day, the reclaiming movement has held.
And it seems that they have a greater understanding, like you said, of the many layers of the ecosystem there. There's a more closeness to the land of a cultivation, not just pillaging it and getting what you can from it, but understanding those layers of the ecosystem and what they can plant almost at the lowest level, then all the way moving up into those canopies, and what that would mean for climate change and cooling properties, biodiversity, and those environmental cycles like watershed. Can you talk us through how they're working with the land made a difference in these areas?
Absolutely. I mean, this is actually one of the strongest justifications for why the reclaimers were able to stay on the land, this ecological aspect. You know, in Indonesia, as in many other places, things like these industrial plantations, also mountaintop removal and strip mining, you know, clear cutting of forests, you know, the production of agrochemicals. I mean, all of these things are kind of the way that these large corporations are using the land, and where life of all types is being killed and imperiled, reduced, right? We're facing this incredible crisis of climate and biodiversity. And in place of all that, Cassiopeia's reclaimers, as they took control of the land, they created these agroforests that are so significant for their biodiversity, far greater than the industrial monoculture plantations that cover now like hundreds of thousands of square miles of Sumatra. They used a form of mixed agroforestry, as it's known, where you're thinking about how to maximize all levels in space of the land. So they're planting some of the tallest trees are usually timber species, really valuable species like red cedar or teak. And then below that, they're planting things like avocado, cinnamon, chocolate, and clove, you know, tree species that do quite well kind of in the shade of these taller canopies. And then underneath that, vegetables, usually mostly for their own consumption or sale to like local marketplaces. Whereas those crops like the avocado and cinnamon and chocolate, they're actually selling those into international markets. This area is famous for its cinnamon, also for its pepper. Both are in large demand across the world. So this agroforestry livelihood is quite remarkable, both for its economic value to the people there, also for biodiversity and the fact that it does support many species of imperiled wildlife in a way that the industrial plantations do not. And then for climate cycles, you know, these agroforests are actually taking carbon out of the atmosphere, and they're storing it in the soil and in the trees that grow. So there's this incredible threefold importance for ecological cycles of these agroforests. And, you know, when we talk about how to effectively cool the planet, how we talk about effectively conserve biodiversity or maintain water cycles, agroforestry is incredibly important. And when we look around the world and understand who's doing it, it's often, you know, similar movements similar to Cassiovera, you know, movements of indigenous peoples or peasant peoples that are putting smallholder agriculture into practice, you know, on their own without the involvement of the state or corporations, and doing it in ways that are addressing these longstanding historical injustices in how land is used.
In the last couple minutes, this was all about, you know, palm oil plantations and the reclaiming of that land. But palm oil, like you said early on, shows up it's in a lot of our foods. So how can our listeners kind of participate in, you know, reducing their consumption of palm oil or even looking for it in their processed foods?
Yeah, it's a tricky one. As we said, you know, it's kind of everywhere and it's hard to find, especially because when you look at ingredient lists, a lot of times it actually just only lists the derivatives of palm oil that are in things like palmitate A. That's a really common one. But, you know, basically there's a nice synergy here with avoiding palm oil and eating really healthy. So, you know, processed foods often have palm oil in them. So, you know, we could do our own health a nice benefit and stay away from, you know, things that come in plastic wrappers. Often those type of processed foods have palm oil in them, you know, things like Reese's bars. You know, unfortunately, some people out there may love Nutella. You know, Nutella's kind of infamous for using tons of palm oil and refusing to look for any sustainable palm oil or you know, any product to switch out of that. So, you know, Nutella, you know, so yeah, thinking about how can we eat locally, what type of fresh fruit and vegetables we can get on our plate that night or that day, that's really the best way to avoid palm oil. But, you know, when we think about even more broadly, you know, what type of food systems are we supporting, right? Are we buying food that's produced by huge corporations from across the world? Or are we looking for food that's maybe produced by cooperatives? Like, there are now over 15 cooperatives that are working with Cassiovera's land reclaiming movement, selling things like bananas, coffee, cinnamon, pepper. You know, how are we looking for, how are we going to buy this food? You know, are we going to the largest supermarket in our neighborhood, or maybe there's a co-op that's doing a lot of work to source that stuff? You know, these are great things to start kind of building into our habits and thinking about how we can use our power as consumers to try to change this market a bit. You know, not everyone can maybe directly support a land reclamation protest, but all of us go to the grocery store every day, and we need all of these strategies and tactics to kind of come together to really create the changes we're looking for in this space.
Well, again, the name of the book is Countering Dispossession, Reclaiming Land, A Social Movement Ethnography. The author is Dr. David Gilbert, a postdoctoral researcher in society and environment at the University of California at Berkeley. Dr. Gilbert, is there a website that people, our listeners, can go to learn more about you and the book and the work you do?
Yeah, I'm at www.davidegilbert.com, and you can find a link to buy the book there or at any of your local booksellers. And thanks so much for listening today.
Thank you for coming on the show.
Yeah.
We We appreciate it. And joining us right now is Utah State University's Larissa Yocum. With the devastating fires happening in California, we're going to take a closer look at fire ecology with Yocum, who is an assistant professor of fire ecology at the Department of Wildland Resources and Ecology Center. We're going to walk through the environmental factors that affect fire, including fuels, weather, and topography. Thank you so much, Larissa, for being on the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Well, before we dive into some of the things that are happening in LA and the devastation that is going on there, and maybe some of the things that are happening ecologically, first off, I want to talk about how you got into this field of work and what the definition of fire ecology is. So tell us a little bit about yourself and what this work is.
So I have always been interested in forests and the outdoors. I grew up in Western Washington, really in the woods. My parents had some, a cabin in the woods, essentially where I grew up. And as I kind of went through school, I was thinking a lot about how what issues are facing the forests in the West. And I really kind of decided that fires and climate change and drought are really the big issues that are going to be facing the forests of the West over the next few decades. And that's where I wanted to spend my time and my energy. So went to graduate school for that and ended up here in Utah got here in 2017. In terms of what fire ecologists do, it's, I don't do all of this, but it really is a broad term that can cover anything from thinking about historical fire and how climate has impacted fire over centuries, to modeling fire behavior. Like you said, it's affected a lot by topography, weather, and fuels, thinking about how fire affects plants and animals, and how those, how different species have adaptations to deal with fire. And then thinking about what happens after a fire, what comes back, where are forests recovering and where they're not, or other ecosystems as well. There are also social scientists who study fire in terms of public perceptions of fire and how we can, better integrate the human perspective on things. So lots of things that fire ecologists do. There's also a lot of knowledge in Native American groups about fire. So there's a bigger effort to try to integrate Western science with indigenous knowledge in the last few years as well. So it's a big category, I would say, that anything to do with fire, there's probably somebody studying that.
Absolutely. And so now as we look at, obviously, what is happening in LA and all eyes are on this area, can you talk us through what the landscape and environmental factors are playing a role there? When I think of fuels and we talk about fire mitigation and we talk about defensible space and things like that, we think about grasses, trees, and shrubs. But in this case, is it densely packed homes? What is playing a role in this devastation?
You're right. I think at this point in California, it's really a lot of those fires have moved from the wildland fuels into essentially urban situations. And so what's driving those fires in those neighborhoods is the homes themselves. So originally, I think all those fires started in wildland vegetation. Southern California chaparral is notoriously fire prone. It has burned frequently over millennia. And in this case, those really strong winds combined with months of dryness have just made it for, a perfect storm in terms of the fire risk. But then again, once it gets into neighborhoods, you can see in some of the pictures after the fires have burned through neighborhoods that there are still some live trees left between burned homes. So it's really the homes themselves that are providing the energy to keep those fires going through neighborhoods. And so it's sort of almost an urban fire at that point.
As far as the winds are concerned, how is that affecting it? We keep hearing that there was actually a pretty good, I guess, rain season that happened, but now we're still in this very dry area and these winds are sweeping through. Can you talk about those two factors?
Yeah, I think that the good rainy season, I think there were a couple, but both last winter and the winter before. And so what that rain did was allow for a buildup of fuels. The grasses and the shrubs did really well. during a couple of wet years. And then my understanding is that it hasn't really rained almost at all for the last 6 or 9 months. It's been a really dry period. So a buildup of fuels combined with super dry period, and then these winds that last week and this week happened to be really strong. Those Santa Ana winds are really strong. And that happens when there's a difference in pressure between basically the Great Basin and California coast. And so those winds are funneled down through mountain passes. They pick up speed and they warm up and they dry out as they hit the California coast. And so if there is an ignition down there, there's really almost nothing anyone could do once a fire starts in those conditions. It's like trying to stop a hurricane or some other force of nature that's just, basically impossible.
And so, what are some of the then after effects that we can expect to see there? What are some of the things that are happening due to these fires that environmentally are going to perhaps have a ripple effect in that area?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think, because a lot of the fuels or the materials that have burned are not natural, just plants and organic materials, there's a lot of toxic ash that's left over from all the things that burn in people's homes. So all of that has to get cleared out. I think there's a risk to the water as well. I know there have been some warnings to not drink the water in some of the areas. So water quality and quantity are some concerns. And then, just in terms of years of construction, I'm not sure how many people are going to want to be moving back into those areas. But I do think you're right that there's a lot of kind of side effects now that people are going to be dealing with for a really long time.
As you study these fires in California, what can it teach us here? You're based here in Utah, and this is where you do most of your research. How can we utilize what's happening in California to have a greater understanding of maybe how we can mitigate fires here or what's happening in our communities?
Yeah. So, across the West, there's, different types of vegetation burn differently. We do have some vegetation that's similar to the California chaparral in terms of shrublands. But a lot of the places that we think of that might burn in Utah, well, we have everything from grass through shrubs through, gamble oak up to, aspen and mixed conifer. And so I think it really depends on where in Utah you're thinking about. There are lots of things we can do to reduce fuels. And then there's also a lot of things, and I think, in California, the only real thing that could have probably been done ahead of time is to better prepare homes. And I am not blaming the people there for what has happened to their homes. I think when you live inside a neighborhood, really the risk of a wildfire doesn't cross your mind. But especially the people in the wildland urban interface, those homes that are right up against the wild fuel, there's a lot of advice and resources out there to help people prepare their homes. So basically removing vegetation from around the edges, removing bark chips, for example, or flammable decks, putting screens up over vents. So there's a lot of things. So basically the couple categories are reducing vegetation in more wildland fuels, and then also hardening homes or preparing homes for trying to resist those embers, basically, if there's an ember shower. So those are the two kind of categories that people can do to prepare.
As we go into, some of the dramatic changes that are happening due to climate change, let's talk about how that is affecting our landscapes here and what you're seeing over the years as our world warms and what's happening now in our forests.
Okay. Well, a couple of things with climate change. One is that, temperatures are rising. That's happening worldwide. And with that, the snowpack tends to be a little bit less and also melt earlier. And so one of the things that we're seeing west-wide is a longer fire season. And that's measured by looking at when the date of the first big fire and the date of the last big fire, and just seeing kind of how long that fire season is. And that's gotten about think it's about a month longer every decade over the past few decades. So that's one thing, is a longer fire season, meaning that in some cases it's year round. I mean, and that's what we're seeing in California right now too, but other places too. There was a big fire in Colorado that burned homes in December a few years ago, for example. So longer fire season, and that also gives the fuels a longer time during the fire season to dry out. So that combined with warmer temperatures is increasing the risk for big fires as climate change progresses.
And what do we need to be studying right now? What is it when you teach your classes and talk to your students and listen to this next generation? What is it that these conversations look like, and what is important for them to understand or know as we move forward in this new landscape?
Well, I think that something that is really that I try to tell my students is that we actually don't have the choice of living without fire. Fire is a part of the world, and as long as there are fuels, fires will burn. And so I think our challenge is really to try to understand how we can live with fire. And what we have a little bit of choice in the type of fire that we have, not necessarily in Southern California, but in Utah. We've been suppressing fires for so long that we're almost selecting for those extreme fires during extreme conditions when there's nothing we can do about it. So I have told my students that, you know, almost the best tool to fight against disaster fires is fire during more moderate conditions. So things like prescribed fires. I think that's really important to understand, is that, yeah, it's really impossible to eliminate all fires forever, especially when this time of climate change. So how can we use fire to prevent these disaster fires that we really don't want to see, where they're burning through neighborhoods and displacing people and even killing people? I think that's our grand challenge, how to live with fire and incorporate it a little bit better into something that people can accept during more moderate conditions.
Yeah, that's an interesting point that you make, and we have talked about that a lot on our show, is that there is good fire, and the environment, this is what it uses to regenerate, and it's a very natural thing to happen in our environment, but we've kind of encroached on these places. We've placed homes and buildings and structures in these areas that would naturally burn, and then we try to push that out or then control fires or have controlled burns. And how do you think that that is all playing in maybe changing the nature of how a natural fire works, or is that what's happening?
Yeah, that's totally what's happening. I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head. These ecosystems that we all live with and among have always burned. They've always burned naturally, and also Native Americans used fire quite a lot to steward their landscapes for all sorts of reasons. And so now, you know, we kind of got used to the idea over, you know, during the 20th century that we could control fire. And we moved into these areas that were very fire prone without realizing it. And so with warming temperatures and this buildup of fuels over the past century, I think we're starting to see that suppression isn't going to work forever. And we're starting to see that the kind of capacity of these ecosystems to burn, and we are now in the way. So it's there's a combination of climate change, buildup of fuels in some areas, and you know what people call a fire deficit. There's been a many missed fires in these ecosystems over decades that now we're starting to kind of see. They're starting, you know, we're catching up a little bit on that fire deficit.
Yeah, and I almost think that as humans, instead of trying to be in control of everything in nature, because nature finds a way, right, that maybe it's upon us to react to nature instead of having nature react to us. In thinking about building codes and maybe changes that need to happen there, or where we build and how we build, maybe a better way to understand what's happening in our natural world and be a part of it.
Yeah, in some ways it would be, I don't actually know if this is true, but I've wondered if it would be cheaper to outfit homes near the wildland urban interface with more fire resistant materials, and just let fires burn. You know, it's, I think there's reasons not to do that. Watersheds, for example, we don't want watersheds burned at high severity because they provide most of our water in Utah. But I think that's a good point, is that we basically have built our homes without a whole lot of thought about the capacity of these lands to burn. And so I think hopefully moving forward, the wildland urban interface, where homes are right up against or intermixed with that wildland fuel, we start to be a little bit more thoughtful about the materials used, because there's good research and good information out there on homes that are fire resistant. You know, we're not the only place in the world that's dealing with this either. Australia, for example, has done there's a lot of good work there in terms of fire resistant materials. I think you're right. I think that could be a really good solution. And also, once you have homes that are more fire resistant, it also puts firefighters at less risk, because that's what they spend a lot of their time doing, is defending homes that are not well prepared. So I think that's a really important point for people who are living in these areas.
Yeah, and you brought up a point about Australia's fire. Is there a way in which communities are coming together and across the planet and talking about this? And are we learning from each other? Is there a way in which we really can understand what's happening in other places to help ourselves?
Yeah, there's a good community of, well, at least of fire scientists around the world who do share and communicate knowledge. I think there could be more of that. I think Australia would have a lot to teach us. I think the Mediterranean as well. Both of those places have a lot of things in common with the West, especially California, actually. And I think, I don't know as much about communities sharing information, but in terms of fire science, there's a lot of that. And it is really helpful to think about, what other places have come up with. A lot of times there's different solutions or slightly different issues that give a different perspective on sort of how the issues we are facing here.
Absolutely. And getting back into how climate plays a role and turning our attention a little bit back into what is happening in California, is climate change, do you feel like that is having a direct impact on the intensity and duration of those Santa Ana winds?
I'm not sure if that connection has been directly made. I know that climate scientists are thinking about that and working on it. I think there's speculation on it, but I don't know if you can, it's hard to pin one event on climate change. So I'm not sure if that's, I don't know if that's been definitively proved yet.
Mm. And as we look at recovery, we always have to think, looking forward, and we talked about the ripple effect that will happen. And there is a lot of obvious infrastructure things that need to happen. But how many years really will it take or are required to have a burn area actually come back to life or recover?
Well, in some places it's really fast, including chaparral. Chaparral is adapted to fire, and a lot of those species resprout. So they'll be back within, this year, not as big, but already coming back out of the ground. And then a lot of the different species have seeds that germinate in response to heat and smoke. And so the plants themselves will probably be back this year, and within 10 or 15 years, maybe be ready to burn again. And the human community probably will take longer. It depends a lot on the ecosystem that burns in terms of the timeline for recovery, but chaparral is pretty fast.
And turning the spotlight back on you a little bit, as you, again, work with your students, what is it that most interests you, or what are some of the topics that you guys are talking about right now, or studies that and research that you're doing that really either excites you or is you find particularly interesting in this day and age?
Yeah, well, some of the research that we're doing is focused a lot on the effectiveness of fuel treatments. So fuel treatments are things like prescribed fire or thinning. thinning out trees, cutting some trees to reduce the fuel density. And we're thinking about how effective those fuel treatments are in reducing unwanted fire effects. And so we have a collaborative project right now with some people in the watershed sciences department here, looking at how fuel treatments can reduce fire severity. So basically reduce the effects on the ecosystem, and then how that would also reduce downstream impacts like sediment delivery to reservoirs, for example. So we have, it's really pretty neat interdisciplinary research thinking about not just fuel treatment benefits for the landscape, but also for fish habitat and those reservoirs. So that's one example. And we have kind of a lot of research on fuel treatment effectiveness in general across Utah. And we're also looking a lot at recovery after fire. We have a long-term project, for example, in the Bryan Head fire in southern Utah near Bryan Head, looking at what species are coming back at, across different elevation bands. So, and we've seen really good recovery of aspen, for example. So there's, you know, encouraging signs in terms of ecosystem responses to fire, even after a really severe fire where lots of trees are killed, there's always something that finds a way to grow and come back. So we're really keeping an eye on what those species are in different locations. So a couple of examples of, I think, interesting research, both that will help think about, you know, how to manage forests better, and then also think about what our forests are going to look like in the future.
Yeah, it is interesting and beautiful, again, how nature kind of always finds a way. And sometimes when we get out of nature's way, the best thing for our landscapes and our ecosystems do occur. But when we look at fire season here in Utah, because of climate change, is it increasing? What has it been over the course of the past couple of years? What would you describe fire season as? And now, as we see the planet warming more and more, has that increased?
Utah has not seen the same increases in fire as many other states in terms of acres burned or, you know, disaster fires. Although we did see, we had a fire burning into October last year, the Yellow Lake fire up in the Uintas, and that was an example of a longer fire season. That's pretty unusual to have a big fire burning all the way into the fall. So although we have not had as, you know, the major problems that most of our surrounding states have, I think we are starting to see some impacts in terms of a longer fire season.
Just getting back into as we're utilizing man-made or, you know, fire retardants and things like that, are you seeing those effects in these fires afterwards, an aftermath because of what we're using to put them out?
I have not seen that. I know a few years ago there was kind of a lot of research on that. And in response to that, there's been more of an effort to avoid putting that retardant in directly into waterways or streams. So I think that there's usually an effort to really apply that more to terrestrial or, you know, non-water systems. And I think because of that, the effects have been not as problematic. So usually that it's such a small area applied really near high value structures like homes, I haven't seen much of an impact farther out into the wildlands.
Well, we'll have to wrap there. Larissa, we appreciate you being on the show. It's Larissa Yocum from Utah State University. She's an assistant professor of fire ecology in the Department of Wildland Resources and the Ecology Center. And we appreciate you joining us and helping to break down what it is that you do and a little bit more about what is happening there in California. Thank you for joining us on This Green Earth.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to This Green Earth. If you like the show and you learned something new, make sure you leave a review, and we'd appreciate it if you click 5 stars.
You can email us your thoughts, comments, and ideas for topics and stories you like us to cover to This Green Earth, all one word, at kpcw.org.